And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's October 9th. 282nd day of the year. Leap year is 283rd. 83 days left until the end of the year. Well, in 768, Carloman the First and Charlemagne crowned King of the Franks. I get the strangest emails. In 1238, James the First of Aragon founds the Kingdom of Valencia. 1410 is the first known mention of the Prague astronomical clock. 1446, the Hangul alphabet is published in Korea. 1594, troops of the Portuguese Empire defeated on Sri Lanka, bringing an end to the campaign of Dinturi. And for those not up on their history, that was a series of encounters between the Portuguese and the Kingdom of Kandy, part of the Sinhalese-Portuguese War. It's considered a turning point in the indigenous resistance of Portuguese expansion. For the first time in Sri Lanka, a Portuguese army was essentially annihilated when they were on the verge of total conquest of the island. So things don't always go as we expect. 1604, Kepler's supernova is the most recent supernova to be observed within the Milky Way. 1635, Roger Williams is banished from Massachusetts Bay Colony after religious and policy disagreements. If you don't worship the way I want you to worship, by God, get out. 1701, the Collegiate School of Connecticut, later renamed Yale University, is chartered in Old Saybrook. 1708, Peter the Great defeats the Swedes at the Battle of Lesnaya. 1740, Dutch colonists and Javanese natives begin a massacre of the ethnic Chinese population of Batavia. They eventually killed about 10,000 of them. 1760, Seven Years' War, Russian and Austrian troops briefly occupy Berlin. 1790, a severe earthquake in northern Algeria causes severe damage and a tsunami in the Mediterranean and kills 3,000 people. 1799, the HMS Lutine sinks with a loss of 240 men and a cargo worth 1.2 million pounds. 1804, Hobart, capital of Tasmania, is founded. 1806, Prussia begins a war of the Fourth Coalition against France. 1812, in the War of 1812, in a naval engagement on Lake Erie, American forces capture two British ships, the HMS Detroit and the HMS Caledonia. Brits were not happy about that. 1820, Guayaquil declares independence from Spain. 1825, Restoration arrives in New York Harbor from Norway, the first organized immigration from Norway to the United States. 1831, Ioannis Kapodistrias, the first head of state of independent Greece, is assassinated. 1834, opening of the Dublin and Kingstown Railway, the first public railway on the island of Ireland. 1847, slavery is abolished in the Swedish colony of St. Barthélemy. 1854, Crimean War, siege of Sevastopol begins. 1861, American Civil War. Union troops repel a Confederate attempt to capture Fort Pickens. 1864, American Civil War. Union cavalrymen defeat Confederate forces at Toms Brook in Virginia. Now that was a rarity. The Confederate cavalry was always able to outperform the Union cavalry until the very end of the war. 1873, a meeting at the U.S. Naval Academy establishes U.S. Naval Institute. 1874, Universal Postal Union is created by the Treaty of Bern. 1900, the Cook Islands become a territory of the United Kingdom. 1911, an accidental bomb explosion triggers the Wuchang uprising against the Chinese monarchy. 1913, the steamship SS Volturno catches fire in mid-Atlantic. When you're on the ship and it catches fire, ain't no place to go, folks. 1914, World War I, the Siege of Antwerp comes to an end. 1918, the Finnish Parliament offers to Prince Frederick Charles of Hesse the throne of a short-lived kingdom of Finland. 1919, Cincinnati Reds win the World Series, resulting in the Black Sox scandal. That was a bribery scandal. 1934, Utasi assassin kills King Alexander I of Yugoslavia and Louis Barthou, foreign minister of France, in Marseille. 1936, Boulder Dam, later had its name changed to Hoover Dam, begins to generate electricity and transmit it to Los Angeles. In the foundation of that dam are several people who fell into the wet cement and couldn't be recovered. At least that's the story that was told when I was there. 1937, murder of non-Catholic priest in Xinding, China, who protected a local population from an advancing Japanese army. Japanese did not look kindly on those who opposed them. 1941, a coup in Panama declares Ricardo Adolfo de la Guardia Arango the new president. Panama is a beautiful country. I spent 3 years there. 1942, Australia's Statute of Westminster Adoption Act of 1942 gets royal assent. 1950, the Goyang Gwimjong Cave Massacre in Korea begins. 153 unarmed civilians were massacred between October 9th, 1950 and October 31st, 1950 by police. After the victory of the Second Battle of Seoul, South Korean authorities arrested and summarily executed several individuals along with their families on suspicion of sympathizing with North Korea. The 1995, the bodies of those killed and put into caves or excavated by their families. In June of 2006, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission demanded South Korean government apologize and erect a monument. Apologies cheap, folks. Alrighty. 1962, Uganda becomes an independent Commonwealth realm. 1963, in Italy, a large landslide creates a giant wave to overtop the Vaujant Dam, killing over 2,000 people. 1966, the Vietnam War. South Korean troops commit the Binh Tai Massacre. 1967, the day after his capture, Ernesto Che Guevara is executed for attempting to incite a revolution in Bolivia. They did not look kindly on that. Che Guevara had been one of Fidel Castro's closest associates. But the story I heard when I was in South America was he was too popular for Castro's liking, so he sent him to export the revolution, and he was killed in Bolivia. Now, the identity of the one those that killed him is still in dispute. 1969 in Chicago, the National Guard is called in as demonstrations continue over the trial of Chicago 8. 1970, the Khmer Republic is proclaimed in Cambodia. 1980, Pope John Paul II greets the Dalai Lama during a private audience in Vatican City. 1981, President François Mitterrand abolishes capital punishment in France, which current events shows was a mistake. 1983, South Korean President Chun Doo-hwan survives an assassination attempt in Rangoon, Burma, present-day Yangon, Myanmar. But the blast does kill 21 and injure 17 others. 1986, The Phantom of the Opera. Eventually, the second longest-running musical in London opened at Her Majesty's Theatre. 1995, an Amtrak Sunset Limited train is derailed by saboteurs near Palo Verde in Arizona. 2006, North Korea conducts its first nuclear test. 2009, the first lunar impact of NASA's Lunar Precursor Robotic Program takes place. 2012, Pakistani Taliban attempt to assassinate outspoken schoolgirl Malala Yousafzai. 2016, the Iraqan Rohingya Salvation Army launches its first attack on Myanmar security forces along the Bangladesh-Myanmar border. 2019, Turkey begins its military offensive in northeastern Syria. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Let's look at holidays and observances. Christian feast days, we have Abraham, Dennis, Dionysius the Areopagite, Gislin, Innocencio of Mary Immaculate and the Martyrs of Asturias, John Henry Newman, John Leonardi, Louis Beltran, Robert Grossetesti in the Church of England, Wilfred Grenfell, Episcopal Church, the U.S., Fire Prevention Day in Canada and in the U.S., Hangul Day in South Korea, Independence Day in Uganda, celebrates Independence Uganda from the United Kingdom in 1962. In Ecuador, they have the Independence of Guayaquil from Spain in 1820. In the United States, Iceland, and Norway have Leif Erikson Day. Romania, we have National Day of Commemorating the Holocaust. And in the United States, National Nanotechnology Day. In Takayama in Japan, Takayama Autumn Festival. And World Post Day. Well, I'm sure we... I mentioned Carloman the First and Charlemagne were crowned kings of the Franks. Well, Charlemagne and Carloman the First were brothers. Eventually, Charlemagne was the main leader. In the year 1000, Leif Erikson discovers Vinland, which is probably L'Anse aux Meadows in Canada, reputedly becoming the first European to reach North America. However, there is evidence to the contrary, though it's in dispute. 1941, FDR approves an atomic program that would become the Manhattan Project. On this date in 1855, Isaac Singer patents the sewing machine. Famous birthdays: Marianne Shad Carey, Emil Fischer, Joe Pepitone, John Lennon, Sharon Osbourne, David Cameron, who used to be the big shot in England. 1973, on this date in history, Elvis and Priscilla Presley get divorced. 1980, Princess Caroline of Monaco divorces Philippe Jeannot. Famous deaths: Benjamin Banneker, George Hainsworth, Che Guevara, Oscar Schindler. Remember Schindler's List? Alec Douglas Holm. The let's see. 869, Charles the Bald is crowned King of Lotharingen. In 1192, Richard the Lionheart leaves Jerusalem in disguise, heading home. He's eventually arrested and held for ransom, which leads to the story of Robin Hood and all that. In 1290, the last of 16,000 Jews expelled by King Edward I leave England. I don't understand the animosity. It just makes no sense to me. 1595, the Spanish army captures Cambrai. Religious dissidents, I understand. You don't always agree with what the powers that be say, but that's no reason for violence. 1651, English Parliament passes the Navigation Act. 1655, the Swedish king, Carl the Tenth Gustaf, occupies Krakow. 1665, due to the Great Plague of London, the British Parliament meets at the University of Oxford rather than the Palace of Westminster. Kind of similar to the pandemic we're dealing with today. In 1779, the siege of Savannah during the American Revolutionary War, Casimir Pulaski, a military leader, was wounded by grapeshot. He dies in March. In 1781, Americans under George Washington and the French under Comte de Rochambeau began bombardment of Yorktown, the last battle of the American Revolutionary War. Lord Cornwallis had to surrender. 1817, University of Ghent officially opens. 1835, the Royal College Colombo established under the name of Hill Street Academy in Sri Lanka. 1837, the steamboat Home sinks off Ocracoke, North Carolina, kills 100 folks. 1800. Remember Montgomery Ward's? Well, in 1872, Aaron Montgomery started his mail order business. Eventually became Montgomery Ward's, and that's now a thing of the past. 1877, American Humane Association organizes in Cleveland. Belgrade, Serbia surrenders to Central leaders in 1915. 1915, Woodrow Wilson becomes the first U.S. president to attend a World Series game. His wife went along to explain it to him. 1932, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin expels Lev Kamenev and Grigory Zinoviev from the Communist Party after a power struggle. 1938, Aaron Copland and Eugene Loring's ballet Billy the Kid premieres in Chicago. How did they get a tutu on those horses, I wonder? 1959, Lee Harvey Oswald arrives in Southampton, England. You know, he's called the assassin, but he hadn't even been charged. There's no evidence to convict him. But the Warren Report. All that having been said, let's go back to talking about some of the history and mystery of El Paso, which I've had so many questions about. We were talking about Richmar yesterday, where you can pan for gold in your backyard. Now, the fabulous mine, the so-called Los Padre mine, was worked by the fathers of the mission of Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe, the ancient church in Juarez that was founded in 1659. And according to legend, you could see the entrance to the mine from the front door of the church. Now, for years, the priest had workers digging the ore and extracting the gold. And they used a little adobe smelter on the bank of the Rio Grande. Some of that gold was cast into bars and kept by the mission. They fashioned church vessels out of it, other religious objects, and of course, the King's Fifth, as it was called, was sent down the road to Mexico City and across the Atlantic to the King of Spain. Then the Indians revolted in an effort to throw off the yoke of the Spaniards. And to protect their treasure from the Indians, the fathers took all their gold bullion, all their precious gold and religious objects, and put them at the bottom of the mineshaft. Then they filled in the shaft and concealed its entrance so effectively that it hadn't been found since. At least that's the story. Now, most folks scoff at the story, but there are a number of places on Mount Franklin where traces of gold can be found, and Rich Marr is just one of them. 1960, the owners granted permission to an El Paso man to prospect for gold, silver, and uranium on the property. And back in 1900, D.W. Record, early day El Paso mining man, and the late J.J. Watts were prospecting in this area. And in what's now the Rich Marr subdivision, they discovered traces of gold dust in the sands washed down off the mountain. Well, following the traces, they discovered the area lies at the lower end of a vein on the mountain containing gold, silver, and iron. And they sank two exploratory shafts, hoping to strike it rich. But the amount of precious metal they found in the vein was too low to permit commercial mining operations, so they dropped the project. The two old shafts are still visible. They lie above Rich Marr, just below the first curve on Scenic Drive. So I guess you have to ask why those two old shafts are associated with the Los Padres mine. Because from the location of the shafts, you can see the Juarez Mission, or you could if it wasn't for the tall buildings of downtown El Paso. So if you decide to buy a home in Rich Marr, some Sunday go in your backyard, drop a pinch of dirt into a pie pan, add some water, rock the pan gently back and forth. Then pour off the water, mud, and examine the bottom of the pan very carefully, and you might find gold. Now, the Pueblo Revolt of 1680 gave birth to one of El Paso's most persistent legends, and that is the Los Padres mine that I was talking about. As handed down from generation to generation, the story holds that prior to 1680, the Spanish Padres had an exceptionally rich deposit of gold on Mount Franklin. And the mine was so located that at night, the fires of the miners could be seen from the bell tower of the mission. But when word filtered south that the Indians had revolted and were killing Spaniards or driving them from the province, the good fathers decided that their time and that of the miners could be put to better use in defending the settlement. And for safekeeping, they hid the mine. Now, they were reported to have taken their gold bullion and all the precious vessels and other objects from the church and put it in the mine shaft, filling it in with reddish dirt from the river bottom and then concealing the entrance so no trace of it remained. And then in the general confusion of the Pueblo Revolt, the location became lost forever. Now, another version says the Indians moved faster than anybody anticipated and massacred the miners, concealed the shaft, and at the face on the ridge of the mountain is that of Chetwa, the chief, guarding of the mine after that. Now, over the succeeding centuries, many tourists, prospectors, promoters, and adventurers who eagerly trudged up that narrow, hand-hewed steps of the ancient mission and strained his eyeballs in the direction of Mount Franklin, trying his best to see any sign of the fabulous mine. And there's no question that people have long looked for the Los Padres mine. And there have been many others who've sworn they've actually discovered the site, but they've been unable for one reason or another to actually lay their hands on the hidden gold, so it still sits at the bottom of the shaft waiting to be found and recovered. Now, I've got another story from Friday, June 13th, 1930. It was found in the El Paso Herald. According to the story, in the Canyon of the Red Doors is hidden a fabulously rich gold mine of the Franciscan Fathers. Now, this came from ancient church legends in the old Guadalupe Juarez. From the door of this 400-year-old monument to Christianity, the canyon entrance, faced with red sandstone, is supposed to be visible to the north. In fact, there's many, many stories I found that the workers' campfires could be seen at night around the mine. Now, old Spanish records said the mine at the Paso del Norte was the richest of all the Spanish mines in the that were being worked in the New World. More than three centuries have elapsed since the legend originated, but the mountains have kept their secret despite persevering search by parties who believe they had discovered the true location. Now, Indian uprisings against Spanish rule and religion drove the Franciscans back into central Mexico about 1680. But legends and records do confirm that they fled the before they fled the mine, they hid where they were digging the gold. Chalices, gold plate, church relics, altar cloths, and other valuables from old Guadalupe said to be removed to the mine for safety. And a huge slab of rock marked with a rude cross was placed over the entrance, and all traces of the mining operation were obliterated. Now, Don Thompson and Jack Ronan of El Paso came upon this legend in 1924, and they gathered all available historical information and instituted a careful search of the Franklin and Oregon Mountains by airplane. Within a few miles of El Paso, they found a place that exactly qualified and matched all the clues to the site. Now, a big rock slide had covered half the canyon, filling it full of shale and boulders at the head. Going on foot to the canyon, they found an aged Mexican working at the top of the slide with a pick and a crowbar. According to Thompson, they questioned him at length and got noncommittal answers. Ronan, who spoke Spanish fluently, then asked him if he was searching for the lost mine of the Franciscans. Turning as white as a sheet, the Mexican finally broke down and admitted it was his objective. He told Thompson and Ronan he had found the cross-marked slab, but been moved by the rock slide from its location over the mine's entrance. After that, the Mexican wandered down the mountain and was never seen by the two again. Well, staking out mining claims at the head of the canyon, Thompson and Ronan began to excavate. A crudely forged octagonal chisel, apparently of great antiquity, was the first encouraging discovery they made. This implement was found in a cave in the canyon wall after removal of part of the slide. Later described by experts as being of a primitive pattern, such as the Spanish used centuries ago. Removal of hundreds of tons of rock reveals several deep caves, but not the entrance to the legendary mine. Well, at this point, they decided machinery would have to be brought in to continue the work because of the tremendous amount of rock to be moved. So after looking at the expenditure they'd have to make versus the potential recovery, they decided to discontinue operations. Now, nothing more has been done to test their observations since that time that anybody knows about, but they are convinced that the mysterious canyon hides a secret of buried treasure under the rock slide. Of course, as with many stories of lost mines and hidden treasures, there's a great difference of opinion about even the most basic facts of the story. But even centuries of confusion can't stop some determined treasure hunters. January 16, 1961, the El Paso Herald Post had another story, written by Charles Swanitz. It says, "The legend of Lost Padre Mine still lures prospectors. Is it visible through the aperture in the mission tower?" Well, according to the story, some do-or-die prospectors still are looking for the Lost Padre Mine. At least that's according to Enrique Lordoy of Juarez. He's a tourist guide, and he's weary because every so often, some of the prospectors make him pilot them along the steep steps, angling up to the tower of the old Juarez mission. And they do that because they've heard that when the evening sun stands just right, you can spot the mouth of the lost mine through an aperture in the mission tower. And these prospectors firmly hold to the view that the filled-in mine shaft is somewhere on Mount Franklin. But others just firmly claim the lost mine isn't on Mount Franklin at all. It's in the Oregon Mountains, 30 miles northeast of El Paso. Which is just goes to prove just how lost Padre Mine is. They can't even agree on what kind of mine the Lost Padre Mine is. Some say it's a gold mine, others say it's a silver mine. Only two things everybody seems to agree on, that the mine is good and lost, that old Chetwa is going to get the lucky finder with his tomahawk. See, old Chetwa is supposed to be the ghost of an Indian chief who took a dim view of white man messing around with his tribe's mind. But see, Valley Indians claim old Chetwa already has bumped off plenty of white men, Spaniards and Americans who got too close to the lost mind. Now, there's one theory proposed by G.A. Feather, who used to be with the New Mexico State University, that the Padre Mine was found with the fierce Yaqui Indians in 1734. They're supposed to have taken out one chunk of silver alone that weighed 2,700 pounds. Then there's a theory that some Jesuit fathers found the mine around the middle of the 18th century, but were kicked out of the area, somewhere in the Oregon Mountains, by the Indians before 1870. But before taking off, the Jesuits were supposed to have hidden their loot in the mine shaft, 4,336 ingots of gold, 5,000 bars of silver, 9 mule loads of jewelry somebody had pilfered off the Aztecs a long time ago. Now, those who favor Mount Franklin as the spot where the lost Padre mine could be found say that a fellow named Robinson and his partner Big Mick found a mine shaft there in 1883. And they're supposed to have hauled very peculiar dirt filling out of the shaft to a depth of 20 feet. Then they gave up. I mean, they came to find treasure, not to work. Sometime later, an American engineer came back from the Tarahumara Indian habitats in Mexico and brought along a Tarahumara legend saying that the lost mine is in Mount Franklin and it's been filled with 20 feet of red silt. 28 years ago, one confident prospector came out happily with the news he expected to find the treasure any day now on Mount Franklin. Well, that kind of hoping's been going on since about 1846, but the Lost Padre Mine is still lost.
Now, what keeps the story of the Lost Padre Mine from being relegated to the realm of myth or the many stories of people who claim to have actually found the elusive treasure, but for one reason or another, weren't able to claim the treasure. I found a good example from an old magazine called Frontier Times. It claimed to only print true stories of the West. Then I took that story and confirmed some of the details here in El Paso. Now, the story in question is called Mount Franklin's Lost Treasure. And it came from Frontier Times Magazine, Western Publications, out of Austin, Texas. And it's dated 1967. The story is written by Jesse Peterson, the sister of one of the finders. According to the story, she knew that her brother Horace and a friend of his named Henry Hammond once found the hiding place of the treasure in the Nuestro Señor de Guadalupe Mission of Juarez, Mexico. Now, her brother died shortly after his discovery. And his friend also lost his life soon after his one descent into the hiding place. And to the superstitious, that would prove there's a curse on the man that tries to recover the treasure. Well, she didn't believe that was the case because disease claimed her brother, and Henry Hammond was a victim of World War I. Now, legend tells of a warning of an attack by Apaches on the Church of Guadalupe. The priest had their friendly Indian converts load the mission's treasure on the back of burros and carry it across the Rio Grande to an old cave or abandoned mine on the southwest slopes of El Paso's Mount Franklin. The treasure, reputedly, consisted of pure silver and gold altar services, rawhide sacks of silver and gold coins, and all the jewelry and other valuables belonging to the people of Juarez. See, the tradition in those days, when the attack threatened, take everything to the church, and God would watch over it. Well, this particular cave was chosen because it could be seen at certain hours of the day from the belfry of the mission, and the priest could tell if it was being molested by their enemies. And the priest who kept a daily record of church affairs is supposed to have drawn a map of the hiding place. When the little settlement was attacked soon after by a large band of hostiles, the priest and most of the defending Indians were killed. The ones who survived were afraid to speak about the mission's treasure, even to their own people. They feared their enemies would capture and torture them for information about its location. Only years later did these Indian converts who knew of the hidden treasure begin telling their relatives about it. And when new priests came to take over the work started by their massacred brothers, they were made aware of the wealth hidden on Mount Franklin. Unfortunately, the map drawn by the slain priest was never found, even though a diligent search was made for it. It was 50 years ago, which would be about 1917, 50 years from when this story was printed, which was 1967, when her brother and his friend decided they'd go find the treasure. And they went about it very systematically. Following the example of those long-dead priests, they haunted the belfry of the old mission. From dawn to dusk, they kept the field glasses trained on Mount Franklin. And at last, they spotted the entrance to a cave. An outline map was made, and one day the two set off on the actual search. They drove Horace's old Ford car to the western slope of the mountain and set about climbing its rocky and sometimes steep sides. Carrying only a sack lunch and two canteens of water, they climbed slowly because Horace was ill with tuberculosis and this was taxing his strength. And although they started from home at an early hour, the sun was already low in the west when they found the cave. And then they discovered it wasn't a cave at all, but the mouth of an old abandoned mine shaft. A ladder made of timber had rotted away, leaving only a rung here and a rung there up and down its long length. Henry volunteered to go down to the cave, but only on a good strong rope, so they decided to keep the finding of the cave a secret from their families so they could return the next day and see what they really found. Time enough, then, to tell folks about their discovery. Both were so excited over their good luck that Horace wasn't able to sleep that night. When his wife, Mary Ann, commented on his nervousness, he simply replied he was tired. Well, she wasn't at all happy the next morning when he said Henry and he were going to do some more looking. Well, the sister said that her brother and her name was Jessie, and Henry left at sunrise, and since they were familiar with where they were going, they made better time this time. Henry said later he made Horace sit down every so often, take a breather before continuing on up the pace. Now, Jesse had been at Horace's home the previous evening and noticed his excitement, and he had told her as she left, better take off from work tomorrow and go with us on a jaunt. Henry could use a good strong helper. And she replied, I'd like to, but I guess I'd better not. Well, in hindsight, if she'd known the true situation, she'd have taken time off all right. She'd have been right in there with him. Horace told her later that he regretted having given Henry such a strict promise of secret. See, Henry Hammond was a big, husky feller who weighed around 185 pounds. He bought a good, strong rope, 60 feet of it, and made a loop at the end for his foot to ride in. And then he and Horace, using the pick that Henry brought, dug trenches in which they rolled big rocks. And the rope was tied around these rocks so that no matter how heavy an object Henry wanted to bring up from the cave, the ropes would hold. Well, Henry had a good flashlight attached to his belt and a pistol on his hip and a scabbard. He told Horace, I don't know why I'm taking this pistol. I'm not expecting any opposition from anything down there. So Horace sat on the side of the old shaft and watched as Henry lowered himself on the rope. As Henry descended into the blackness of the mine, Horace said he could hardly keep up with the progress. It seemed to him his friend had gone hours before he heard a couple of shots being fired from down below. Within a few minutes, Henry was climbing back up toward daylight, pulled himself over the side with Horace's help, and sat, legs dangling over the edge of the opening while he mopped sweat from his face. When he finally got his breath back, he said, darn if that cave isn't full of rattlesnakes. I never saw so many. Must have been 100, and they didn't want to be disturbed. So Horace said, you didn't get bit, did you? And he said, nope, but it didn't because I didn't try. He said, one struck me on the leg, but the leather chaps he was wearing saved his life. Well, Horace wanted to know what else besides rattlesnakes did you find, any boxes or chests down there that might hold that treasure? And Henry replied, there certainly are. There's an old ornamented chest, several ollas. Those are big, like water jars. And some small sacks. They look like they may be rawhide, I think. And he said, Horace, we've got what we came to find, but how are we going to get by that den of snakes? They aren't playing tag with me again. And Horace said, I don't know, but there's got to be a way to do it. Well, today that problem that faced her brother and his partner wouldn't seem so formidable. Gas bombs are available, but that day when Horace and Henry came away from the mineshaft, they were baffled and frustrated. Henry again pledged Horace to secrecy, and maybe they couldn't find a way to get rid of the shaft full of snakes, but they weren't going to risk anybody else coming along, finding an answer and taking over the treasure. And Jesse said from that point on, when she spoke to Horace about the lost treasure, he just evaded her questions. Well, shortly after that, Henry got drafted into the army for World War I and never came back. And her brother became weaker as the months rolled on, and one day he called her to come to his bedside and told her they'd found the treasure. Now, this was before they learned that Henry was a casualty. Horace told him, "I'm going to draw you a map of the mine shaft, and if something happens to Henry, you're going to get the treasure out and divide it three ways. One share to his mother, one to my wife Mary Ann, and one share for yourself. You just have to figure out a way to beat the snakes." Then he smiled and said, "I still get a laugh when I remember how Henry looked the day he crawled up that rope. He was scared." Now, Horace, who was only 34 years old, died a few days after they had that discussion. His wife and Jesse searched every place they thought he might have put a map, and many places that were far too obvious for a hiding place, and they didn't find anything. Maybe remembering his promise to Henry, he changed his mind and didn't draw it. Well, Jesse said she'd searched dozens of times for the mine shaft. She'd gone into the old church belfry at different hours, using, as they did, good strong field glasses. Never seen so much as a shadow on the mountainside that she thought could be a mine opening. And her children have gone with her over miles of rocky, cacti-covered terrain. Friends have gone with her as well, but they never found the cache. Several years ago, a beautiful cathedral was built beside the old Juarez Mission of Guadalupe. And this building, unfortunately, cuts off all view of the Franklin Mountains from the belfry of the ancient church. Well, every once in a while, she said, when she feels real spry, she drives out on the Mesa Road and searches around the area in which the mine just has to be. The view from the west side of the mountain is still beautiful. It's always worth the climb, even though she doesn't find anything. Well, it's an interesting story that raises a number of questions, in my mind at least. For example, did Horace Peterson and Henry Hammond really find an abandoned mine shaft containing a vast treasure dating from the days of the Spanish occupation? Were the two men stopped from claiming that treasure only by 100 or so rattlesnakes? Did they both die without revealing the location of the treasure? And then, of course, I guess the most important question of all needs to be asked. Is the treasure still there, guarded by the deadly reptiles waiting for the next lucky finder to figure out a way to get around the guardians? Only one way to find out. You know, many believers in the Lost Padre mine feel the lost diggings are in or around Indian Springs Canyon. Now, that canyon gets its name from the gushing spring of crystal clear water that was once a dependable source of water for the early pioneers in this area. Now, what's not widely known today is that Indian Spring Canyon was once named Spirit Canyon because of the weird and mystic appearance of Will-o'-the-Wisp and other unusual occurrences. Now, there's absolutely no doubt that it's been a location filled with its share of death and stories of buried treasure and a lot of strange happenings. A number of news stories from the early 20th century can give you some idea of the uniqueness of this hidden canyon. I got one story from January 3rd, 1937. It came from the El Paso Herald Post. 5,800-foot mountain picnic park only 14 miles from downtown El Paso. Herb Newhouse lives there with a dog and a goat. According to the story, there's a delightful, rugged picnic spot 14 miles from El Paso that very few people have visited. It's Indian Springs on the east side of the Franklin Range, 5 miles out of the Newman Road from the city limits. Picnic retreats under the management of Herb Newhouse, who lives at the springs with his dog and his goat. Two springs run the year-round, and wild vegetation covers the canyon walls. The altitude is 5,800 feet, 2,000 feet higher than El Paso. days are cooler than in the city, and the nights are cold. Picnic sites, a large Indian kitchen, consists of 35 holes in the rock where Indians once ground grain. Then there's a hole in a canyon wall in which it said bandits used to hide. Park's been named because of an Indian's profile carved by nature on the mountain rock. And there's a good road up to the springs. Newhouse came to El Paso from Michigan to seek health. When he arrived here, he was bedridden. Now he works with pick and shovel at his Indian Springs home. He said El Paso climate's the best health giver in the world. Well, though the park is named Indian Spring, apparently the Indian Spring's not flowing any longer. In fact, it appears from the following story that though there are two other flowing springs, the original Indian Spring hadn't flowed strongly since 1885 and stopped even trickling in 1911. This next story came from July 10, 1938. Indian Springs near El Paso, flowing water. For the first time since 1885, Indian Spring and Indian Spring Park is flowing an estimated 500 gallons of water a minute. That's according to Edgar Park, a longtime observer of the spring. He said the park is located 8 miles north of El Paso on the Donna Ana Road, which is now in good repair. View of the mountain stream, which originates about 2,000 feet below the 7,000-foot crest of the mountain, is well worth the 8-mile journey. He insists that the stream flows about 3/4 of a mile down the slope of the mountain to the flatland, where it seeps into the ground and disappears. The wonder of a renewed Indian Spring fascinated citizens of El Paso, as shown by another story I found in the El Paso Herald Post, dated July 11, 1938. Springs a leak as 100 see water gush. According to the story, the spring at Indian Springs, 8 miles north of El Paso and west of Newman Road, sprung a leak yesterday as hundreds gaped. Reports that the spring was flowing for the first time since 1885 drew hundreds to the spring. All day long, cars were parked in long rows. They continued to arrive until dusk. There were scores of picnic parties. Along about 11 a.m., the spring sprung a leak when water began to gush from a hole lower down the mountain. One blonde girl, which I guess is appropriate, said, "Why, it's wet and everything," talking about the 500 gallons of water a minute that flowed from the springs. This one sentence tells me that this young lady is a future rocket scientist whose job still will be to explain unusual occurrences to those who are less intelligent. Other occurrences in Indian Spring Canyon are anything but amusing, though. As reported earlier, this canyon's one location where treasure hunters have felt the Los Padre mine might be located. Of course, hunting the hidden treasure in the Franklins is not without its dangers. Many of those who've looked into the story of a lost mine in the Franklin Mountains have certainly come across stories of ghost fire, spectral horsemen, and other unexplained phenomena that's supposed to be guarding the treasure. I've got one story from the El Paso Herald Post, dated November 2, 1973. Headline is, "Has the ghost fire of Lost Padre Mine returned to the Franklin Mountains?" Recent El Paso Herald Post caller said she and her husband saw a strange flickering light on the mountain in northeast El Paso. They determined it wasn't a star, it wasn't a vehicle, but couldn't figure out what it was. Another report from the northeast was from a family who saw a luminous red glow that hovered and moved rapidly away. And that was in a populated area on the slopes of the mountain. Well, with dozens of USO sightings being reported around the country, these incidents don't seem like much, unless they're a revival of a phenomenon noted during the 1930s around Indian Spring Canyon, near the present Trans Mountain Road. Several El Pasoans said in past years they saw a fire, a tall pillar of smoke that glowed in the dark. They thought it was the work of spirits guarding the Lost Padre Mine, which many legends locate in the Franklins. Henry Gardner was a caretaker of Indian Springs Canyon in 1939. He lived alone in a one-room cabin. Relics of ancient Indian habitation dot the area. Legends of Indian spirits and buried gold have been told about the canyon for decades. On March 15, 1939, about 10 p.m., Gardner saw the fire. He said, I'd just gone to bed. Suddenly the cabin was lit so brightly I was nearly blinded. Looked out the window and saw a fire dancing up and down about 50 feet away. Flame was 3 feet wide, bluish green. It moved eastward. It grew smaller. Then it darted into the mountain and vanished. Next day, I couldn't find a trace of that fire anywhere. Brush wasn't even scorched, he said. That same night, a Boy Scout troop was camped in the canyon, which is a privately owned picnic retreat. A member of the troop named Billy Hill said he saw the light twice. July 1933, an El Paso couple camping in the canyon saw the fire that burned for an hour. They ran toward it, but could never get near it. Ms. Glenn Corbett said the fire was a steady, bright spot as big as a dollar. The late Edgar Park, pioneer developer of northeast El Paso, once owned the area where the lights had been seen. Many years ago, he said a canyon caretaker had been led into a bed of cactus by the lights. The light indicates the position of the Lost Pottery Mine, according to legend, he said. When Mr. Jackson, the caretaker, saw the light one night, he ran after it, hoping to find the mine. Wound up in the middle of a bed of cactus. He never could catch that light. Next time he saw the light, he studied its position carefully. It's been seen often in that one particular place. Some reports indicate the light's seen more often in rainy weather. Same thing said about the Marfa lights that you can see down near Marfa, Texas. And unexplained over a period of many years. Folklore of Mexico and the Southwest usually associate these lights with buried treasure. A portion of the Franklins where most of the lights have been seen is on the Castner Range, which is in the process of changing hands. Visitors to the area are discouraged because of the danger of explosives, which have not been cleared since the time the land was a military firing range. Well, these stories from 1939 make very interesting reading and give more detail of the earlier incident that I've talked about in this section of the book. Another story from that same time period, El Paso Herald Post, April 21st, 1939, by Tom Meanley. The Lost Mine Ghost Fires Dancing Again in Indian Springs Canyon near El Paso. It flares up and lights the mountains and then fades away. According to the story, the weird dancing fire of the Lost Pottery Mine had reappeared in Indian Springs Canyon. Now, the canyon is located 12 miles north of El Paso, west of Newman Road. And Henry Gardner, canyon caretaker, dreads a return of the mysterious fire that lit his cabin as bright as day 4 weeks before. It's a rocky, lonely spot filled with stories of massacres and Indian spirits and a fortune in gold buried in the Lost Pottery Mine, which is supposedly located in that canyon. According to Mr. Gardner, that on the night at 10 p.m. on March 15th, that fire lit my cabin so brightly I was nearly blinded. Looked out the window and saw the fire dancing up and down about 50 feet away. Now, Gardner said he wasn't frightened, but fears that the fire may return does make him nervous. He said, I was trying to light a letter by the light of my lantern, and the flickering lantern light reflected in the window reminded me of the fire, and I got so jittery I had to stop writing. Now, he was adamant that the light could not have been man-made. Boy Scout Troop 11, led by H.R. Miller of 3011 Nashville Street, was camped in the canyon that same night. A number of the Boy Scouts saw the strange light. Billy Hill, who I mentioned earlier, was walking down the path from Spirit Springs about 7:30 when I saw the first fire. I thought it was somebody's bonfire, then it bounced up and down, then it disappeared. And we were the only ones camping in the canyon. And then it came back and lit up our camp. Fire appeared as a bright spot of light to a number of others. The strange fires of Indian Spring Canyon led a former caretaker into a bed of cactus, as I said. And the light is said to indicate the position of the Lost Pottery Mine, according to legend. Now, if the bluish green light does guard the fabled Lost Pottery Mine, then it keeps company with another fabled guardian, the Witch of the Franklins. Now, this was a story told by Dr. C. Shonishin, professor of English at Texas Western College. They did a simulcast on KTSM radio and KTSM TV called Look to the Mountain, It was done in 1953. According to the Mexicans in the valley, nobody can come near the Padre's treasure and hope to live. The story is told that the witch lives in the mountains nearby and constantly guards the entrance to the mine. If anybody gets too close, she sees to it something bad happens to them. People have seen her hiding in the rocks, always watching, waiting, guarding the treasure. The story also always told to illustrate the power of the witch of the Franklins, it concerns a couple of woodcutters from the Isleta who were working in the Franklins. It was time for them to eat their lunch, and they sat under an overhanging bank where it was warm and sunny. And while they were sitting there, a rattlesnake crawled out of a nearby hole, and one of the woodcutters noticed that the snake had gold dust on its back. Immediately, the two believed that they had discovered the lost Padre mine. Unfortunately, they didn't have any tools, so one of them stayed to mark the spot, and the other went down the mountain to get a shovel. And when the one that had gotten the shovel came back, he couldn't find the spot where they'd eaten their lunch, and he couldn't find his friend either. Big landslide had buried both the spot and his friend. And that was confirmed that the witch had caused the landslide, at least in his mind. Then we have the treasure of Skeleton Cave. Sonneson also told the story about a cave that's supposed to be in the Franklins where there are three skeletons hanging from the roof of the cave. Now, these three unfortunate souls have been hung with strands of barbed wire around their necks, which is, you have to say, a rather painful way to die. But one that certainly takes your mind off the fact you're being hung. According to the story, hidden nearby is supposed to be a large treasure. Further research revealed the tunnel-like cave is supposed to be in an obscure canyon on the west side of Mount Franklin. Allegedly, this cave is filled with the loot of ambushed wagon trains, stagecoach, and train robberies, as well as rotting articles of wearing apparel and the bones of bandits, soldiers, Indians, and Mexicans. Mouth of the cave is hidden by a heavy tangle of brush against the face of a bluff. Cave is supposed to run into the mountain about 150 feet, ending with where the bodies of the three men, two large and one small, are hung from the ceiling. These bodies are described as mummified and bound and hanging with barbed wire. Now, while there's no additional detail given by Dr. Sonneson, it appears to be a garbled retelling of a story that I've written about called The Outlaw Loot of Slim, the Bandit Chief. The next story is called The Gold on Smelter Hill. Now, the Lost Padre Mine is not the only source of sudden wealth in El Paso that was waiting for a lucky finder to bend down and pick it up. There is another treasure known as the Mount Franklin Cache. It's supposed to be hidden just east of the Asarco Smelter on a flat-top mesa in the foothills on the west side of Mount Franklin. According to the story, Fortunato Salaz was a young man born in a valley not far from El Paso. Time of the story that I'm telling, Fortunato was living just north of El Paso at the settlement of La Esmeralda, settlement for those who worked at the smelter. Now, he wasn't living in the actual smelter village, as he was not employed by the smelter. Instead, he was living in a temporary camp a few hundred yards from the village, where the Southern Pacific Railroad was putting a bridge across the Rio Grande. Fortunato was a member of the work crew, whose duty was to dig with pick and shovel. Fresnos and horse-drawn scrapers moved the earth loosened by the large plows. Men did a finishing work with the picks and shovels. And after a long day of back-breaking work, as with any group of men cut off from the pleasures of home and family life, the main amusement in the work camp was drinking and playing cards. But Fortunato didn't drink and didn't know how or want to play cards, so he usually tried to find a quiet place where he could sleep undisturbed. However, on the weekends, when the rest of the crew would go into El Paso or Juarez for enjoyment, Fortunato would leave the immediate area to find a quiet place where he could enjoy some peace and quiet. Many times, he'd walk further up Mount Franklin where he could enjoy a view of the valley and be alone with his thoughts. We're going to talk more about this in our next show, but for tonight, now, we have come to the end, not only of the show, but of the week. So until Monday, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.